Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. Today is Sunday, October 30th. Amanda Borchel-Dan here with our diplomatic correspondent, Lisa Berman, and settlements reporter, Jeremy Sharon. Hello to you both.
Hello. Good morning.
Hi, Amanda.
You know, Israel moved to daylight savings time. Did you both enjoy your extra hour of sleep? Laser, how about you?
Oh, I loved it, but I'm not sure about these early Shabbat start times that are coming up.
That's a good point. And Jeremy, as a father of some young children, how is daylight savings time for you?
Daylight savings time meant that I got up technically at 5:30 in the morning instead of 6:30. So as you might imagine, I'm less well disposed to this change of clocks thing.
So what can you do? This is what we have so far. Now, we're going to go around the world a bit today with Laser, speaking about the Brazil elections, arms for Ukraine, and the historic Lebanon maritime deal. In the second half of the program, our sleep-deprived Jeremy will give us highlights or lowlights, depending on your political taste, of the Otzma Yehudit policy goals. So Laser, let's start with you. Lebanon's 89-year-old President Michel Aoun stepped down today, but on Thursday, with little pomp and circumstance, Israel and Lebanon signed a historic maritime borders agreement. Now, do you think that the next government will actually honor the agreement?
Which government are you referring to, Israel's or Lebanon's?
Good point. Actually, Lebanon has no government on the horizon. So let's start with Lebanon.
Yeah, I think this is clearly in the interest of both sides, even though I certainly served the opposition in Israel, like Benjamin Netanyahu, and some elements of in Lebanon to criticize it. But this is a deal that was signed with the United States and submitted to the UN. It seems like something that is beyond partisan politics, even though, let's remind everyone, this was signed only days before the Israeli elections. So you certainly can't take the political dimension out of this entirely. But I can't imagine that once it's signed, that any side would go through the drastic step of turning it back unless there's some major change in relations between the two sides.
Tell us a little bit about the letter from U.S. President Joe Biden.
Sure. So this was a letter that there were rumors about, reports about, that was being drafted up. It's a letter of guarantees. A day after the agreement was signed on Thursday, so on Friday, Israel and America agreed on the final text. A senior Israeli official told me that this guarantees Israel's economic and security rights. It affirms that Israel sees that 5-kilometer line of 10 buoys stretching out westward into the sea from Rosh HaNekrah as the status quo line. Again, not as a border, status quo line. And it affirms Israel's economic rights in the Kana gas field. Israel's supposed to get supposed to get 17% of the profits from that field as well. So this affirms that U.S. is backing Israel, that if Lebanon or Hezbollah probably would try to challenge any of the agreements, that America would support Israel there. I will add that in the cabinet meeting, Naftali Bennett, who is part of this government, is said to have kind of cast doubt on the importance of such a letter, saying that if anything happens, if Hezbollah tries anything, attacks our gas rigs, the U.S. is not going to send troops. And he's correct in that. But certainly the political cover and that guarantee can be meaningful. So this is probably something that was in the works for, it's not a surprise for Israel that the American side had promised this to Israel. And there was reference made also to the Jerusalem Declaration that Biden signed when he was here this summer. So this is a series of guarantees that the American administration has given to Israel. Again, it's paper. Things can change. Again, administrations can change. But I think this is something that Israel certainly sees as meaningful and is presenting that way.
Okay, in the same theme of changing administrations, perhaps, let's spin the globe a bit. There's a neck-and-neck race happening for Brazil between right-wing President Jair Bolsonaro and his leftist challenger, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, better known as Lula. Since we are the Times of Israel, tell us what a win for either candidate may mean for the Jewish state.
Sure. So this is an election in a very large country, the world's fourth largest democracy. Bolsonaro comes out of that growing evangelical religious Christian support for Israel, and he's been a very firm supporter of Israel. He even tweeted that he would move the embassy to Jerusalem. In the end, that didn't happen. They made do with a trade office. But he has been a close ally of Benjamin Netanyahu and has really been outspoken in a part of the world that is not necessarily known for its pro-Israel sentiment. There's a lot of Palestinians and Lebanese and in South America, and a lot of leftist sentiment as well. So that's basically the fight there. Da Silva, or known as Lula, was Brazil's leader about a decade ago. He has since sat in jail, but he really does have a dedicated following amongst the poor, amongst the workers. And Bolsonaro has his following amongst the more pro-business, pro-Western, kind of pro-American in the business community. Lula is leading. He was supposed to be leading by double digits. They had their first round of elections, and it was much closer than they thought. So Bolsonaro certainly has a fighting chance here, but I don't think he is favored in this fight at all because of the polls. But as we've seen repeatedly, polls tend to skew a little bit to the left, and politicians on the right tend to overperform them. And that's what happened in the first round as well. So the question is how far these polls are off.
Okay, let's zoom back to our side of the world and Ukraine. We've discussed the idea of Israel aiding Ukraine in anti-missile defense systems a lot on the podcast already. But you recently spoke with Natan Sharansky, who had a 20-minute meeting with President Zelensky. What did Sharansky convey to you about this meeting?
I spoke to Sharansky immediately after he got out of the meeting. So it was a 20-minute one-on-one meeting with Zelensky. This is something that Zelensky initiated. Sharansky is the head of the Babi Yar Memorial Board. So he was there with one of his members, and they intentionally went to Kyiv to have their meeting as they usually do. But it was a statement during the war, and they haven't had it there in a couple of years because of COVID. And Zelensky reached out and initiated that meeting. He said it was a very informal meeting, a warm meeting. Actually, Zelensky's chief of staff took the official picture of the meeting. Said it was, you know, Zelensky looked more tired than usual, but was quite vivid and quite engaged. And then Zelensky met for 45 minutes with the two board members that were present, and then with Ronald Lauder and former U.S. Senator Joe Lieberman, who were joined by Zoom to talk about the future of the Babi Yar Memorial Site. Zelensky pledged his government's support for opening a larger museum there that will focus on primarily the Holocaust by bullets, which is the early stages of the Holocaust, in which mobile squads were shooting Jews, and the biggest event of which was the Babi Yar massacre in 1941. And so they spoke about the importance of Holocaust commemoration and the lessons that have not been learned, you know, as evidenced by some of the Russia's activities in this war and the reaction of the international community. Obviously, that puts Israel in somewhat of an uncomfortable light, since their support for Ukraine has been much less than what the Ukrainians want, especially around air defense systems. And that's also something that Zelensky brought up.
Okay. And finally for you, because I know you have to go off to a meeting, Israel hosted the Albanian prime minister last week in yet another sign of warming ties between the two countries. What was the reason for his visit last week?
Sure. So Albania has long been an Israeli ally. She's the ambassador to Bosnia as well, but she sits in Albania, and that's intentional. That's an intentional sign. But this was around cybersecurity. Albania and Iran are traditionally enemies. And there was a major cyber attack or a series of cyber attacks in July that have been attributed to Iran. And Albania kicked out Iranian diplomats, severed diplomatic relations in September. And so this was focused around gaining access to Israel's cybersecurity expertise. And the president, Edi Rama, met with Gabi Portnoy, who's the head of Israel's cybersecurity apparatus. And I was at an event at the Waldorf Astoria for him. He's a former basketball player, 6 feet, 6 inches. And again, his country is quite well disposed toward Israel. So this is tightening the ties even further, with that focus on their cyber defense.
Okay, Laser, thanks so much. And head off to your meeting, and we'll hear about it later in the podcast.
Thank you. Have a great week, both of you.
We'll go to a short break now.
Israel will be going back to the voting booths on November 1st. It is final. Back to the voting booths.
Welcome to Paralyzed Nation. This is Israel's fifth election in less than 4 years. But what are these elections actually about?
The Politics of Deadlock.
A face-off between populist identitarian politics and the effort to preserve Israel as a liberal democracy.
Small shifts at the margins.
I don't think we're going to have a solution. We're heading towards another deadlock.
The rise and the mainstreaming of what we might politely call the far right.
A referendum on Netanyahu.
I'm Amanda Borsell-Dan. Join me and our Times of Israel political analysts,
Chaviv Retigur,
Jeremy Sharon,
Carrie Keller-Lynn,
Tal Schneider,
David Horowitz,
as we drill down on these hard-to-answer questions in this limited edition podcast series that is exclusively for our Times of Israel community. Welcome to Paralyzed Nation. And we're back. Jeremy, we are days ahead of the elections, and obviously we've spilled a lot of ink on MK Itamar Ben-Gvir, the head of the Otzma Yehudit party, who has emerged as the quote-unquote star of this campaign. You recently wrote a piece that basically delves into Otzma Yehudit's policy. So I want to narrow in on one aspect of this very nuanced piece and ask you, how does Otzma Yehudit compare with European far-right parties such as the AfD in Germany?
So this article came about because a couple of years ago, in fact now 3 years ago, I was interviewing Itamar Ben-Gvir for another publication. And it was a telephone interview, and we talked about several of his policies. And then I asked him about his policy regarding the West Bank and the Palestinians. And at the time he said, well, we want to annex the West Bank and make it part of sovereign Israel. So I said, well, what are you going to do with the Palestinians? Will they won't have their own autonomy. They won't have their own state. They'll be part of one state, which is a greater state of Israel. Will you give them the vote? And he evaded for several minutes. He didn't want to answer the question. And eventually he just said, listen, I'm hanging up the call. This is part of a media plot against me, and I'm not going to participate. And he hung up. Earlier this month, in an interview with one of the big Israeli broadcasters, he said out loud, we're going to annex the West Bank. And instead of evading the question, what are you going to do with the Palestinians? He said, they're not going to get citizenship. They're not even going to be able to have health insurance like other Israelis. They won't even have freedom of movement. He was asked, you know, can they go and, you know, you've annexed all of the West Bank. Can Palestinians go and move and live in Tel Aviv? And he said no. So he was really saying the extreme aspects of his policy out loud just a couple of years after he'd absolutely refused to answer the same questions I had for him. So this prompted me to go and have a look at the rest of his platform in detail, the party manifesto, which was put up for the 2019-2020 elections, and see what other policies are there and how they compare to other far-right parties, especially in Europe. So I went to have a look, and I looked at the Alternative for Germany party. That's a radical or far-right party in Germany. I looked at the National Rally, which is a radical or hard-right party in France. I looked at the new Brothers of Italy party and several other far-right parties, the Austrian Freedom Party. And I looked at their policies, and one thing which struck me is the following, is that one of the principal policies in the Otzma Yehudit manifesto, that's Itamar Ben-Gvir's party, is that they want to create a government ministry to encourage emigration, to encourage people to leave the country. Specifically, the Arab-Israeli population and the Palestinian population should they be able to annex the West Bank. And so I looked at, you know, this is quite a radical idea that you want to target one ethnic minority to have them leave your country because you're not happy with their presence in your country. So I looked at these. I looked at these other parties. I looked at AfD. I looked at the Austrian Freedom Party, and so on. And I found that even though they are very extremely harsh in their rhetoric towards immigrants, towards new immigration, and they want to ban immigration, and they want to overturn asylum laws so that people can't claim, you know, refugees can't claim political asylum in their countries, they all fell short of actually calling for citizens to emigrate. They weren't saying that, you know, citizens of an ethnic minority already present in the country and who are legally there and who are citizens, they weren't calling for them to emigrate. So where did I have to go? I had to look at, I went to parties which were even more extreme, essentially neo-fascist or neo-Nazi parties. And it was only amongst that kind of party where I found that calls for creating some kind of a mechanism to get rid of ethnic minorities already in the country. So one example of this was the Nordic Resistance Front, Nordic Resistance Movement, which is a pan-Scandinavian party present in several Scandinavian countries. And they are viciously anti-Semitic, racist, and they outright say we'll have an institute, a bureaucracy for deporting ethnic minorities. Now, this is substantially different from Otmar's policy, because Otmar says their ministry will encourage emigration. Although it should be noted that Itamar Ben-Gvir, we asked him, what does that mean, encourage? How are you going to do that? What happens if people don't want to go? And he refused to answer that question. He also refused outright to have an interview. So the Nordic Resistance Movement, that is forcible deportation, but nevertheless, they're establishing a government bureaucracy to encourage ethnic minorities to emigrate out of the country. A more similar policy was the British National Party, which is a party which is rooted in the neo-fascist, neo-Nazi parties of Great Britain of the 1950s and 1960s. And their policy is, we will also create a government ministry for encouraging emigration, and they will offer financial incentives to emigrate. And, you know, this is a party which is extremely, is racist, is anti-Semitic. They want to ban, for instance, Shechita, Jewish religious slaughter. And so you're seeing that in order to compare Otmar Yehudit's policy on emigration, you have to look at really the far-right parties in Europe to come up with a good parallel.
Jeremy, this is just fascinating. Obviously, there will be a link to your story in our program notes. Thank you for joining me today.
You're welcome, Amanda.
Pleasure. Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. And thanks to our producer, Gilad Brownstein, and to Gili Amar for this out-of-this-world music.
You can find us daily wherever you find your podcasts.
And on our mothership, timesofisrael.com. Like what you hear? Consider rating us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify to spread the word.
And be sure to check out our weekly feature, Times Will Tell, released every Friday. Until next time,
Shalom.